Okay, I think probably some of you know that this is Robert Millikan on the left, and therefore, what's going on the right? Yeah, the oil drop experiment. It seems, though, that after Millikan became the head of Caltech, he developed a reputation for, let us say, perhaps taking credit for other people's ideas. And there was this college graffiti that appeared on the Caltech campus back in the 1930s that down on the bottom it says, "Jesus saves, but Millikan gets the credit." Now I bring that up because these are the people that deserve credit for anything about pet shielding. This is the original Task Group 108 report, and this is where the methodology and the techniques come from, and I think these are the people that should be getting the credit. I'm going to go through any of the background methodology and especially the equations very quickly, spend a little bit of time focusing on the way I view the actual design of the shielding, and then talk a little bit about testing. And the basic idea is pretty simple. You have a patient that has radioactive material, and they're irradiating somebody else, and if the somebody else gets too much radiation, that's a bad thing. So we have to do something about that. And the limits we've talked about, 5 millisieverts for the controlled areas and 1 millisievert for the uncontrolled areas. When we're considering a shielding design, we have to think about at least 4 factors. What radionuclide is being used, how much activity is being used, what's the distance, and what's the occupancy in the area that we're designing the shielding for. And all those lead to, are part of the calculation of dose in that area. And so the dose rate, though in this equation, since we were in graduate school, if you take the activity times the gamma ray constant and divide it by the distance squared, you get the dose rate at location D. So what radionuclides and radiopharmaceuticals should we design for? Well, again, more data from the task group report, but if you look at both the dose rate constant and the 1-hour integrated dose, fluorine 18, if you look at the 1-hour integrated dose, is much larger than these radionuclides here and these radionuclides here. As long as we're not dealing with iodine 124, which people have already said may come along but isn't clinically used now, a design for fluorine 18 will be sufficient to cover the other radionuclides that are usually used. And, you know, when I first learned dose rate constant, a gamma constant, I thought there was a gamma constant. And when I read this report and found out there isn't a gamma constant, but there are, in fact, at least 6 gamma constants, it was really enlightening to me. And the task group report suggests that we should use the tissue dose constant, but something else you should be aware of is that the equations in the task group report correct this value for self-absorption of the patient. And therefore, the number in the equation doesn't look exactly like 0.148. So what's the activity? Well, the activity, you have to take into account that the activity in the patient decays away while the patient is in the uptake room. At our facility, we've always used 90 minutes in the uptake room, but other places use different numbers. And so you correct for that by calculating the effective activity over that period of time. And the task group report gives you values to use for 30, 60, and 90 minutes of 0.91, 0.83, and 0.76. This is kind of like the effective half-life calculation, except that you don't carry it out to infinite time. If you go to the scan room, you add to that at this point, the patient voids about 15% of the activity, and then you calculate the effective activity in the scan room from that point on while the patient is in the room. The distances in the report are in meters, and of course the architectural plans that we get are still in feet, and I'll show you how I specifically take this into account. And there's these standard distances that we use for distances from barriers and so on, and I think every single speaker that we've had so far has shown this slide. Another thing that you have to worry about is if you have lower occupancy areas, then you always have to consider what's beyond that space. And what this slide shows is if we had an 8-foot corridor that had a fully occupied space behind it, and if the internal source, the distance to the corridor is this distance, then the exposure to the fully occupied space would be about like this. For the uptake rooms where the distances are often short, then by the time you inverse square law them across to the other side of the corridor, you're okay. But if you're talking about rooms where the distances are greater than a little over 5 feet, then the controlling factor will be the space across the corridor rather than the corridor itself if you have full occupancy. So you calculate the annual dose, and then you have to have an occupancy factor, and the recommended occupancy factors are the same ones as NCRP 147, even if you have a classroom full of young children adjacent to the room. You then calculate the transmission factor using this equation that we've seen several times for the uptake room and this equation for the scan room. You can then use the graphs that are in the report or the Archer equation to calculate the amount of lead that's necessary with these coefficients. So, how can the physicist participate in the effective design of PET shielding? Well, early intervention, as early as we can participate, is important. The design can greatly influence the shielding cost and the ease of use of facilities. The sites often have three-dimensional aspects that affect the shielding and need to be considered. Architects often have naive ideas based on nuclear or X-ray shielding, and therefore they have no idea what the cost for shielding a PET facility is are likely to be, so that they would just prefer to design things sort of the way they usually design things. And then once they get the price, they may be too far along in the design process to go back and redesign the facility. So it's good to get in early and to help people with the design of the facility. And there are other radiation protection aspects besides shielding that need to be taken into account. Now this is a PET facility that was kind of a medical physicist's dream, because this facility is only going to exist for about 2 years. So you know when you do the design that you don't have to worry about what people are going to be doing 3, 5, 7, 10 years down the line. And in particular in this facility, a place where we were able to help them out, and I'm going to just blow this up a little bit, there are two injection rooms here, and The facility, this is in a medical office building, but the people who run the PET scanner also have a mammo facility in this space over here. And initially they had the mammo facility set up so that there were secretarial offices along this wall. And by changing these to mammo rooms, we were able to significantly decrease the amount of shielding that was necessary and reduce the cost substantially. Now, this is a facility. It has the scan room here. It has three uptake rooms here, another uptake room here, and the thing that was, there were a couple of issues about this one. One is that there's a secretarial occupied reception area here, and what I wanted them to do was to make this uptake room, the stretcher uptake room, and use the other ones generally, but they said they didn't want to do that, so we ended up shielding it for this. But the other thing that was an issue about this is going on to the third floor of a hospital that was built in 1956 and has had bits and pieces added onto it many times since then. So there was this very complex three-dimensional geometry and a great deal of difficulty figuring out what the existing walls might be made out of. So we spent a lot of time doing that. But it turned out that, this is a little sketch of the scanner, it turned out that this area down here wasn't too big a deal, but in this space up here, there's a presently unshielded area that has some catwalks and things like that the workers actually walk back and forth fairly frequently going to a maintenance space. And so we had to put up some shielding. The rest of the space above here wasn't a problem. So we just put a lead panel coming in right here, and actually only about 4 feet in each direction, so that we're able to protect this area up in here. Another thing that is important when one's considering the design of a PET facility is how far the techs have to escort the patients when they leave the uptake rooms. Actually, I should show them going to the bathroom first. But again, you want to make this design so that the patients move the least amount of distance necessary, so that to minimize the radiation dose to the technologist. There are some other possibilities to make shielding a little bit easier. One is to use a maze for the uptake rooms. And so far I've only worked with a fairly limited number of facilities, and they've all been short enough for space that they actually didn't want to make the uptake rooms large enough so that you could have a maze. We had a CT scanner a number of years ago that was put into a space where there wasn't room for a control room right adjacent to the space, or at least not one where you could have the console in the usual location with a window looking into the room. And we built that facility with no window between the control room and the CT scanner, and we had two video monitors that looked at the patient. By state regulation in South Carolina, you have to have at least two ways of viewing the patient if you don't have direct viewing. And when I visited that CT, I actually really liked the setup, because I actually thought that the technologist paid more attention to the patients by looking on the video monitors than they did normally looking through the window. And I would think that that would could be very useful in a pet facility. Again, we haven't built one this way. It would allow you, one, not to put in the expensive shielded window. Secondly, you could do things like place the console facing the other way across the control room, so you increase the distance slightly. And actually, if you're looking at it in the most detail, it would actually probably change the radiation to some of the organs, so that might reduce the effective dose a little bit. There are other factors that the physicists can participate in. General assistance with design, lighting in the uptake rooms, the availability of intercoms. I like them to have an intercom between the uptake rooms and the control room, but also an intercom between the uptake room and the corridor right outside the uptake room, so that the technologist can absolutely minimize the amount of time that they're working with the patient. So I set up a spreadsheet for doing the calculations. And my general philosophy about spreadsheets for PET is kind of as follows. First off, I have some notes that try and tell me and everybody else in the future what I had in mind when I was doing this. And that includes stuff like this is designed for F-18. If other radionuclides are used, and I misspelled shielding, should be reevaluated. It's not designed for iodine-124, but it would work for short-lived PET agents, and that's misspelled too. Then I put in what design values I use, 1 in 5 millisieverts per year. It's designed for fluorine-18. It's designed for 555 megabecquerels administered activity. Now, this is designed for 100 patients a week, and this is the one that's going into our facility, and that seemed excessive to me by a lot. But their theory is that once this is in place, it's going to be the PET CT facility for as long as possible. Well, actually, they're planning to shut. This hospital was built in 56, and they're planning to shut it down in 2022, I think. So their theory is that this should last from the time it's opened until 2022, and they wanted to be sure that they had enough capacity to use the facility for that many, many years. In general, I try to write on a spreadsheet who I get the workloads from, so that if there's a question afterwards about why did you use that crazy workload, I can reference back, well, I used it because I talked with so-and-so. Okay, uptake, time in the uptake room factor, the patient voiding factor, time in the scan room, and so on. Now then the next thing I do is I do a calculation to determine the shielding required for a barrier, assuming that we're only dealing with radiation from that one room. And I specifically put in my spreadsheet the change from feet to meters, occupancy, design, the barrier factor, calculates the concrete and the lead, and then I put in my recommendation for the amount of lead in that barrier, both numerically and in architectural units, and I say how high in my own code, at least, the shielding should go. This means it would go all the way up to the ceiling shield. And then I annotate the architectural plan so that it's pretty clear to everyone what barrier that we're talking about. Now, having done that, what I do is consider the areas where, come on, where there's a radiation of an area from more than one location. And in particular here, I'm really just worried about a radiation of this point from this uptake room and this uptake room. And so I put into the spreadsheet the measured distance to the point of interest. And the spreadsheet automatically looks up. There's some internal stuff here that's not so easy to explain. But it looks it up and it inverse squares to that based on my recommended shielding, what the annual exposure from each of those barriers would be at that point, and then totals them up and compares them to the design limit for that space. So I therefore, and I can look at this, and I can adjust, go back and adjust the original barrier if necessary. But this way, you can take each of the points of interest in the facility that are exposed from multiple locations and determine that your shielding design provides enough shielding for that location. So let's talk about shielding evaluation for a moment. As we've said already, PET shielding is complex. You use a lot more lead than is used for a typical radiographic installation. Also, the safety factor is much less than for most diagnostic installations. In a typical diagnostic installation, if you put in a 16th inch of lead, as everybody's been saying, you'd be covered for a wide variation in workloads. Whereas in a PET facility, you don't have that degree of safety that's in a diagnostic room. And exposure usually occurs from multiple sources. This is a little facility that we have, which took a PET CT scanner in a trailer and added onto it a little building. And so it has the scanner in the trailer, an uptake room in the trailer, an uptake room in a little building. And it actually ends up looking like this. There's the PET scanner down here, PET CT. There's an uptake room back in this corner. There's an uptake room in here and a hot lab in here. And when you look at this, here it is adjacent to a hospital. This wall is a quite thick concrete wall. This space up here has a very, very thin kind of wall. And so you can see that when you are evaluating the shielding for a facility like this, you have a lot of areas that you have to take into account. Of course, there's the fence and the parking lot. Not really too much different than a lot of PET facilities, but it's easy to visualize how complex the problem is. And my take on this is that the purpose of the shielding evaluation is to ensure that the radiation doses are below the levels required by regulation, are consistent with the shielding design, and that the shielding is properly installed. So my priorities are to check for proper construction, to determine the adequacy of the shielding. And I think that's consistent with the NCRP 147. We've used, or evaluated at least, three types of instrumentation to do these measurements. They are a large volume ionization chamber, like the RadCal 1800 cc chamber, a portable pressurized ionization chamber like the InnoVision 451P, or a portable sodium iodide survey meter, which is the Exploranium GR135. All three of the devices gave approximately equal readings when we tested them, and all certainly could produce accurate measurements. But we preferred, since we have it, the portable sodium iodide survey meter, which was somewhat more sensitive and more convenient to use than the other devices. So the first thing we do is we check for proper construction, looking for voids and gaps. And it's certainly helpful to be able to go in while they're still working on the facility. And again, in the few that I've done, I could in two of them, but not one of them. But in any case, if you put a source in each of the locations that you're interested in, and then you just use a meter to scan for the gaps and voids, and that goes pretty quickly. But then, when you want to actually evaluate the annual exposure at a particular location, you have to take into account that that location may be, in fact will be, irradiated by several locations. And so we found it more convenient to check these locations all at one time. And we do that by taking radioactive sources that are scaled according to the activity that would be used in each of those locations over the course of a year. So we find the scaled source strengths that give the same radiation exposure as the total activity that is used in the room, and we place the sources in all the patient locations, and we measure the dose at appropriate locations. So if you imagine a particular location, the annual dose is the dose rate times the number of patients times the time each patient is in the room. So you take the dose rate from a particular patient times the number of patients times the time each patient in the room. But you can get the same effect by taking the activity, which is the average patient dose, times the number of patients times the time each patient is in the room, and then the annual dose is that dose rate multiplied by 1 hour. So that you can set up equivalent circumstances by imagining a patient and multiplying by the number of patients and the time, or imagining a source that gives you an equivalent annual exposure. I have a bunch of equations that look at this in the handout, and we're not going to spend too much time on that. But effectively, if you take the activity times the number of patients times the time, that gives you a dose rate which corresponds to a dose at a location, which is the same as the activity from a single patient, which gives you a dose rate which is multiplied by the number of patients times the time. So the average patient activity in the uptake room, these are the same factors that come into shielding design: administered activity, time the patient spends in the room, the number of patients in the room, and the patient self-attenuation factor. The patient self-attenuation factor is the one that's a little different, since it's not built into the equations like it is in the task group report. And so you can just calculate this out, and these look much like the equations in the task group report. In the scan room, it's the same thing, except you have to allow for the time that the patient was in the uptake room and the voiding factor to calculate the activity that would be in the scan room. So the administered activity, the time the patient spends in the uptake room, the fraction of activity voided, the time the patient spends in the scan room, the number of patients in the room, and the patient self-attenuation factor. So the equivalent activity is the product of this average activity times the number of patients times the time they're in the room. So if you take that for each of the scan rooms and each of the uptake rooms, that would give you a dose at one point that is equivalent to adding up all the individual exposures. Now, if you just calculate that out, even for this small facility in the trailer, you get pretty large activities. These are in millicuries. And while I'm a pretty brave guy, I don't think I want to handle a 20,000 millicurie source, so we need to do something. So all we need to do is scale it down a little bit. So we take some scaling factor, sigma, and we just divide these out, and we get scaled down source sizes. And so in this case, a scaling factor of 500 gives you a scaled activity of a 41 millicurie source in one uptake room, 10 in the other, and an 18 millicurie source in the scan room. And those you can deal with. So you want to compare the results to the design value. So you take your design value, you take, and we want to correct for occupancy factors. And if we take the design value divided by the dose multiplied by the occupancy factor, and that's less than 1, we're good to go. While you're doing these measurements, though, you have to correct for the decay of the sources during the measurement. And so naturally, we have a little spreadsheet which has the data about the source and about the facility and about the scaling of the source. And then when we do the measurements, like this, and this is split into two lines, so you can't read as we go across here. So this spreadsheet at the top is split here. So you take a location like where the control room operator is. So that's designed for 5 per year. We did it at 843, and we got a meter reading of 2.3. Corrected for the time for the source calibration, that gave an annual estimate of 0.71 at that location. That was 14% of the p-value, and so that passed. Then you go on and do the same thing with the occupancy factor. Clearly, this is a controlled area, so the occupancy factor is 1, so you get the same result. Now, the one that I wanted to look at next, though, was something that we did intentionally. This is the corridor door to the uptake room, and I'll just see if I can, how long it takes. That's this room here. And to begin with, the only people that come into this facility are the technologists and the patients, occasionally, someone else. And it was our thinking that we would just put a 16th-inch lead door on this room to make it easier on the technologist, even though we knew that if you just did a calculation, the radiation dose in the corridor would exceed the ALERA design value. While one is not supposed to use an occupancy factor for controlled areas, it just seems that in reality, the occupancy at that location was going to be extremely low. So, lo and behold, when we measured it against the P of 5, it failed, and the exposure there was about twice what would get you to 5 per year. But if you take the 50 annual limit, then of course that's 10 times larger, so it's only 19%. And so we were really quite satisfied that we had met what our real intention was to have a workable facility that gave people a good degree of radiation protection. Now I'm going to speak very briefly about evaluating the lead in the wall using a source in the room. So you can use a source in the room, and we don't normally actually do this. I think once you've established that you've met your design values, there's really little point in who cares how much the lead actually is. And I think it's difficult to do accurately, as I'll show you this. So, but if you measure the air kerma at some point outside the wall, you determine B, then you evaluate using the chart from TG108, or you can calculate using the Archer equations. Again, using this here. The formulas for doing this are basically from the Archer equation. But if you want to have an exposure of about 10 microsieverts per hour outside of the barrier so that you can make a pretty accurate measurement of the number, it takes a lot of radioactivity. So, for example, if you wanted to measure about 12 millimeters of lead, you'd have to have 100 millicuries of fluorine-18 on the other side of the barrier to get 10 microsieverts per hour. So we've done this using, this is just a table that shows what happens on the graph. And you end up with absurdly large activities. So while you could measure the thinner barriers fairly accurately if you wanted to, it's pretty hard to measure the thicker barriers. But by using this little sodium iodide detector, which is a little bit more sensitive, we did set up a measurement just to see if we could do it. And we took First off, we tried to see if we could reproduce a zero thickness barrier, and we got minus 0.4 millimeters of lead. Not too bad. And then we took one of the barriers in the trailer, and we measured it at two different distances, and we got within 7 and 11%. And I thought, that's too good to be true, but I was willing to stop at that point. So I want to thank you for your attention. This may seem complicated when you first get started, but someday you'll look back upon this and run into a bus. Thank you. Okay.
This is very interesting stuff. I actually had two questions. One's kind of a silly question, and I may have just missed the answer, and that is why the two uptake rooms were so very different in the size of the source that you had to put into them.
Oh, because the way that facility is, the workload isn't very large, and the one we built in that little room is farther away from the technologist and actually a little nicer than the one that's in the mobile trailer. So we deliberately, if we had had a larger workload, we would have had to balance equal numbers in each of those uptake rooms, but we didn't, so we didn't plan it that way. And it works very well. Most of the patients go into the adjacent room.
If you've got somebody that sort of wants to get into the evaluation part and they're looking at buying instruments, it sounded like you were recommending a scintillation counter of some sort or another. What would you say the minimum scale on that thing needs to read for it to be useful for evaluation?
Okay. Well, this one that we have goes... This is a very particular one. It's this particular model of a device called the Exploranium. And this was a machine that came along just when people got interested in homeland security. So the company originally was designing them for industrial use, and they sell a lot of them for homeland security. It works in your hand pretty much like an ionization chamber, except if you want to, you can switch it and get the sodium iodide spectrum. And so it reads down to what, less than a, it reads down to about a tenth of a microsievert. Actually, it goes down into nanosieverts per hour. So it's very sensitive.
I guess I'll add on one more question about how much does an instrument like that set you back?
There are a few, I don't remember, a couple thousand. Eugene, do you remember?
Somewhere around 8,000, 9,000.
Okay, yeah, they're pretty pricey. But having said that, I mean, we justified it so that we would have an instrument handy if somebody came into the emergency room and we needed to do a, you know, a check to see what they were contaminated with. But you don't, a 451, a pressurized ionization chamber,